What is creativity? How does it operate? What are its parameters? What does it mean to be creative? In this series, WROELP explores the creative processes of people in different realms of life to see for ourselves.
This is Heather Rose with WROELP, Radio Free Roanoke, continuing our series on the creative process. Joining us today is Lois Weaver, a Guggenheim-winning writer and performer, activist and director, to expound on our creative process. Hi, Lois.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for inviting me. How exciting to be in touch with Roanoke, my hometown.
Uh-huh. Well, first off, can our listeners get a little background about yourself?
Sure. How far back you want to go?
Well, I'm kind of old. You're born here, right?
I was born here. I was born in Mount Pleasant, behind the Mill Mountain Star. And lived there all my life until I went away to college. And I went to Radford College. I went to Mount Pleasant Elementary School. I went to William Byrd High School. I was a cheerleader and I did drama. And I worked at Hieronymus Department Store. Those are people who might remember when Hieronymus was around.
Yeah.
And then I went to Radford and studied theater. And during that time, I performed in the summers in the Mill Mountain Playhouse when the Mill Mountain Playhouse was on the mountain. So I had two summers doing that while I was in college. And then I went off to college, and then I went off to Baltimore and did some peace and justice work and some theater work. And then in 1973, I located myself in New York for the most part, although I come back and visit all the time.
Nice. Well, please describe the area of your creative endeavors.
Well, I mean, I studied theater. I fell in love with theater in high school at Byrd. And then I went to college. I went to Radford College, and I fell in love with it even more. And I had a wonderful education there because it was a very small department, and it was a women's college at the time. So we had to do everything. We played the men's parts. We built the sets. We made the costumes and everything. And so I really learned theater inside out. So, and around about the time I graduated was the early 70s, and I became politicized, I suppose, by the Vietnam War, and also about the coming feminist movement was just being born, and all of those things were really exciting me. And I was trying to figure out how I could make my theater work and my political interest combine. And I learned how to do that. I went off to Baltimore to do some political work and joined up with a theater company there that were doing experimental theater, alternative theater kind of techniques. And I learned there that I could really use theater to make my own work, to say the things I wanted to say. So I went to New York pretty much right after that and got involved with a company called Spider Woman Theater, which was a Native American, primarily Native American, but a mixed women's group. And we got together to make women make performances about women, basically. So it was an early feminist theater company, early women's theater company. And that's where I really got my training. I was with that group for about 7 years. And so since 1980, I've had my own company called Split Britches. And what I've done with that company is basically make my own work. So with my partner, Peggy Shaw, and then with another woman that started the company with us, Deb Margolin, we created shows that helped us answer those big questions that we had about what it meant to be human beings on this planet. And as we developed our work, and now it's been over 40 years, we create our own things about the concerns we have. But in some ways, the working on those performances help us go through the challenges that we face in life. It sort of works both ways. We sort of, our life depends on making work, and you know, our work depends on our life. So it kind of works both ways. So we write, direct, and perform our own pieces and tour them around the world, basically. Well, around the world, but a lot of places.
Huh, right. Well, much of your work focuses on public engagement. Can you detail how you engage the public?
Well, that's interesting because that's part of the work that has just come about probably in the last I guess, well, maybe the last 15 or 20 years, because what we were doing to start with is making performances that end up on a stage and people come to it and they engage with us because we engage with different kinds of issues, what it means to be women, what it means to be lesbians, what it means to be artists and, you know, under Reagan, because we made a piece like that. So we made made plays. And so people engaged with us because we engaged with certain kinds of issues that were also other people's concerns. But then I got into this thing where I really liked talking to people and I really liked talking to the audience. And I had developed this character called Tammy Why Not. And Tammy Why Not is born and bred in Roanoke for absolutely for sure. And she's my, I say that she's my country western singer who gave up country and western music in order to become a performance artist. And so Tammy likes to go around making shows and singing songs, but what she really liked to do is get the audience involved in a conversation. So my shows with Tammy would be conversational. So we would I made this one show called What Tammy Needs to Know About Getting Old and Having Sex. Mm-hmm. So in the shows, I'd perform and do singing and, you know, monologues and stuff. But then I'd get into the audience and ask them questions about how they felt about getting old, how they felt about getting old, and were they still having sex? And, you know, if so, how often and all that kind of stuff. And I really loved that. So I started calling Tammy my facilitator of public engagement. And then that sort of grew into some other things that I developed, which were based a lot on having grown up in the South and in Virginia. I started something called the Long Table, which was like the kind of dinner table I grew up with, where we often had very heated debates at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. And I thought if we could set up something in public that felt like sitting around a supper table, it might encourage more people to come to the table and have a real proper conversation. Mm-hmm. So I developed this thing called a long table, which was an alternative to a panel discussion that was just more egalitarian, gave more people a chance to talk, encouraged more people to talk about things that were closer to them rather than some maybe big academic issue or political issue. And then I also developed something called porch sitting, which very much came out of my growing up in Mount Pleasant, which is just, you know, inviting people to come and sit facing in the same direction and wonder out loud the way you do when you sit on a porch. Mm. You know, I wonder who's coming down the road, or I wonder what the weather's going to be tomorrow, or I wonder what the midterms are going to bring, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I've developed all of these things I called public address systems, which are alternative ways for people to come together in public and have informal conversations about some serious subjects sometimes.
Cool, that's cool. So how do you interact with the public and get them to engage with you?
Well, Tammy was a great one for that because, you know, she wears a big blonde wig and she has a big country accent and she gets right up in your face and she loves everybody. She's kind of more of a Dolly Parton, mm-hmm. you know, influenced character, where she's just curious about everything, and you know, she wants to know everything, and she lets people know that she's curious. And something about that kind of clownish, although I wouldn't call her a clown, I call her my superhero, but that kind of bigger than life character encourages people to talk to me, and people would tell me things they might not tell me if I interviewed them as Lois. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I think that happens with things like the long tables and the porch sittings is that I just try to use, I also do something called care cafes. I try to use very familiar settings, places that we know how to behave. We know how to behave around a supper table. We know how to behave on a porch, but most of us, how to behave in a cafe maybe. So I try to set them in places that feel familiar, and then I give them a set of etiquettes or rules so they know what's going on. And to be honest, it's been surprisingly successful. People tend to go for it. There's something about those domestic familiar places and the way we set it up that relaxes people a little bit, and they eventually get on board and come to the table and have great conversations.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, who's like, where has it been located?
Well, the long tables have been located. I started them in Brazil because I was there with my company doing some work with prison, women in prison. And we wanted to have a big discussion about the work we'd been doing. So I decided to experiment with this idea of the long table. So it started there. And I've done them in Australia, and I've done them in Asia. I've done them in the UK and around the United States, in New York, California, Oregon, London, and all over the UK, and including Scotland and Ireland. But what I do is I say that they're open source formats, so it doesn't require me to be there all the time. So I on my website, I offer the instructions for people, how can people do it themselves. So you could decide to have a long table if you wanted to have a public event. And a lot of people have been doing it in conferences, for book launches. I had some people do them because some developers were trying to develop a piece of property and were trying to have conversations with the community about what that would mean. And they used the long table as a way to get people come to talk that wasn't as intimidating as something like a town hall where people have to stand up at a mic. So it's gotten around mainly because I've said to people, use it. It's not just, I use it. I take it places with me whenever I go do shows. Sometimes we do these things, but, you know, other people have done it, and that's what sort of spread it around more than anything, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, your work also has a feminist bent. Can you expound more on that?
Well, it's funny. Sometimes I say that my public engagement work, or my, you know, with my long tables and with Tammy and with Porch Sittings, is probably the best representation of my feminist politics, because my feminist politics really are rooted in the idea that absolutely everyone deserves a place at the table, mm-hmm. regardless of gender or gender identification, or regardless of race, ethnicity, mm-hmm. class, any kind of background. We all have a place at the table. And my feminism is about trying to come up with shows or plays that illustrate that and invite people to think about that in different ways about different subjects, but also these public engagement, I call them protocols or formats that will allow people to come and do that. So I think that's the basis of my feminism, and the fact that as a teacher and an educator, I want to encourage the potential in absolutely everyone, particularly women. And obviously, as a feminist, I privilege, you know, the stories of women and women identified people, because we have been marginalized in so many ways over the years. And a lot of our stories have been ignored. A lot of them are coming out now, which is great. But I privilege that, because I think that we have a lot of history to make and time to make up for all the times when we've been quieted and silenced and abused and all those other things that women have gone through. So, I care about women. And I care about everyone having an equal opportunity. So that's what I call my feminism.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure lots of people can relate to that. Well, can you tell us about your current work?
A current piece that we're performing, I'm performing live. We just finished a run at La Mama Theater in New York, and we're on our way for a tour in the UK right now, is called Last Gasp, A Recalibration. It's a show we were working on right before the pandemic, and my partner Peggy and I were working on this show called Last Gasp, and this was two solo pieces that we were going to perform on the same night, and sometimes we'd do a little bit together, and then we would each do our own pieces. That was the plan. Mm-hmm. And then when the pandemic hit, our shows were canceled, and Peggy was in London, because I teach part-time in London, and we were there rehearsing, so we had no place to live, and these people, Peggy had no place to live because I was living there for a while. And these people said, well, we have this empty house that we plan to renovate, this old Victorian house. We're going to renovate it, but we can't do anything until all this mess is over. Why don't you just live there? It's completely empty, but you know, you can, we found beds and people loaned us things, and we populated it enough to live there. And we lived there for 5 months, a big, like, you know, 4-story house, completely empty. Just us too. So we started rehearsing our play using Zoom with our collaborators. And as we rehearsed it with Zoom, we recorded the rehearsals, and we started to think, wait, this, we could make a little film out of this. So we ended up making a film called Last Gasp, Working From Home, which was the material that we would have done on stage. But we did it in this house. The house, this old house, was also kind of in its last gasp, because it was about to be completely torn about and redone. So we made this film, Last Gasp Working From Home, and we circulated that. We still are circulating that. But then we decided we wanted to finally do the live version. So we did a version that was a hybrid, me on stage and Peggy on the video. And it was an exploration of all the things we explored initially, but we also added those ideas about presence and absence and the things that we'd been through in the pandemic. So we're just in the middle of doing that right now.
Cool. So where is that taking you?
Well, it'll take us we're going to Belfast in a couple of days to a festival. And then we're going to outside of London, and then we're going to Manchester, England, and a few other places in England. And then who knows? I mean, we're just kind of, it's just been born.
Yeah.
So it takes a while for us to see where it's going to end up.
Gotcha. All right. Well, how do you make the leap from the idea in your head to the art you produce?
Wow. That's a good question. I think we take our time. Usually it takes us 6 months to a year to bring a show from that very tiny idea to a full development. We do a lot of research because we incorporate a lot of popular culture in our work. So, you know, we'll look at ways to reference old TV shows because Peggy and I are quite interested in comedy. So we often look at the old 50s live TV shows like Sid Caesar and Imogene Coco or Mike Nichols and Elaine May. We look at, you know, we look at all kinds of musicians and sometimes we do some kinds of lip syncs or we make our own versions. But using popular, or we sometimes use whole movies. Like we made a piece that was based on Dr. Strangelove recently.
Mm-hmm.
We made a piece that was based on Streetcar Named Desire about 30 years ago. And we made our own version of that.
Mm.
So we look around the things that are spiking our interest and we locate one or two and we locate a theme that we're interested in, aging, or Peggy had a stroke quite a few years ago. So we made a piece about her experience of having a stroke, or she was going through menopause. We made a piece about menopause.
You should talk more about that. That's like a silent subject in our society.
Absolutely. So she made a very wonderful piece in 1996, I think, about menopause. I agree with you. It needs to be that's exactly what we do, is we look for the stories that haven't been told. The first piece we ever made was called Split Bridges. And that was based on the stories of my three great aunts who lived in Mount Pleasant on the old home place. And they were very eccentric ladies who, you know, had a big farmhouse left to them by their parents, but they end up all living in the same room and wearing loads of clothes and, you know, just being very eccentric. So we like to take these eccentric, individualistic stories, things that maybe we uncover the hidden things, expose the things that don't get talked about very often, and we make work about it. And we start to write. You know, sometimes we call it automatic writing, just write loads of stuff. And like my friend Peggy says, if you write enough words, three of them will probably be okay to you.
They'll stick.
And then I edit that into a piece. And we usually sort of try to filter in three or four ideas into one piece. So there's lots of things going on. So they're not really plays in that very traditional linear way, but they're kind of a collage of lots of different ideas that we hope make sense to people and give some meaning to people.
Yeah.
We work with a sound designer who helps us create, you know, make backing tracks, but also sound for the monologues, and work with a choreographer to do do movement. And then I usually direct the pieces.
Oh, cool. So being a director, what does that entail?
Well, good question. I mean, I think as I'm a kind of an unusual director because I direct from within, so I'm on stage as well as being a little bit off stage and seeing and keeping the whole picture. But I think mainly the job of the director is to just keep sight of the whole thing and make all of the connections and try to be the interlocutor between the audience and the performance itself in some way. So often I'll come up with the initial idea. I'll get us all going. I'll get some, create some exercises that get us, you know, writing or moving or researching in a particular direction. And then I'll do a lot of the editing. So I sort of start directing early on before we even stand up. I'm putting the words together, putting the scenes together. And then, you know, I decide how to create each little moment. The scenes are often these crazy moments where we put together music and movement and a story. We do a lot of storytelling that comes from our own lives. And I just keep my eye on the whole thing and come up with, when we get stuck, I try to come up with a solution of how to make something work.
Yeah, that's a question. How do you overcome creative blocks when or if you meet them?
I think this sounds like a funny thing to say, but I take a walk around the pond. Even when there's no pond, I just step away and just take a walk and leave it all behind and acknowledge that I'm blocked, but not worry about it. And once you step away, and this sounds a little Buddhist, I suppose, but once you empty your mind, very often the energy and the solution will come into it. So, yeah, I always use that technique. Okay, I'm going to take a walk around the pond now because I feel stuck. Also, you can be stuck for days at a time. And the other advice I would give to other artists is don't panic. Just wait. It's like Peggy and I used to say about, you know, when people fall in love and that suddenly they panic because they're falling out of love. But if you wait, very often you'll fall back in love. So I feel the same way with the creative process. And I suppose the other thing is, over the years, I've developed certain kinds of exercises or techniques that might jog me in a different direction. Sometimes you're just going too hard, too fast, too determined in the same direction, and that's what blocks you. Mm-hmm. And if you could just take a very sharp left turn, sometimes that'll shake you up and you'll come up with an idea that'll take you out of that place.
Yeah. Well, what's a real life situation that inspired you?
A real life situation that inspired me in my life?
Like a real life situation that inspired you to create work.
A particular piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting question, because most all of our pieces in some way or other have come out of either a problem or a question or a challenge or an inspiration. Let me think what would be a good one to describe. We talked about feminism a little bit. There was years ago in the sort of 80s, there was a big debate within the feminist movement around censorship and pornography. And those were the extremes of the debate. And it was basically, to what extent do, as feminists, how can we be proactive and pro-sex, but how can we be careful and vigilant when it comes to the ways that pornography abuses women, basically, and mm-hmm. can abuse women and can be abusive. And so that was a big debate within the feminist community. And it was a kind of, I couldn't quite get my head around exactly how I felt about it, because I feel like people need to have the freedom to express themselves sexually and creatively, but at the same time, we have to look after each other and have to be careful of the power dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So someone said to us, I was in the middle of thinking about that. And then someone said to us one day, you know what, you ought to do a play based on Little Women. And we went, what? Little Women, that's not our style. But for some reason, when we were thinking about that issue, we thought, well, let's think about Little Women as a possible backdrop for this discussion. And what happened then is we started to research Louisa May Alcott, and we found out that not only did she write children's literature with her right hand, but literally, but with her left hand, she wrote these serialized, potboiler, sensationalist, sexy stories that got put in the newspaper in a serialized way. So we sort of had that debate. That kind of debate within one person. Anyway, so that finding out that about Louisa May Alcott was a big inspiration for making the work that we made, which we called Little Women, the Tragedy. So that was one thing that inspired us. I think we made a piece more recently called Lost Lounge. which I've been living in New York since 1973. And I think like anybody who lives in a slightly urban, even Roanoke for that matter, you've seen your neighborhood go through loads and loads of changes, you know, and you've seen like for even downtown Roanoke, you know, mm-hmm. used to be such a thriving downtown. And now it's all, you know, lofts, you know, mm-hmm. high expensive lofts. And
so gentrified.
That kind of, yeah, gentrified. Exactly. So that kind of gentrification, we began to see that a lot in New York and to worry about what happens to our memories when we lose our landscape. You know, like if I didn't have Mill Mountain to look at when I came back to Roanoke, what memories would I lose if for some reason that mountain was, you know, demolished or taken apart? And we feel the same way about certain businesses or certain street corners or certain, you know, old lounges that we used to go and have a drink. They were all being gentrified and disappearing. So that inspired us to make a piece called Lost Lounge. And we put the characters, I don't know, Louis Prima is a singer, is an old lounge singer. So we sort of used him and his partner, whose name just flew out of my head. But people who know Louis Prima will know her name as well. And, you know, we just, that inspired us. We wanted to talk about loss, that the kind of loss that we feel when progress happens. Not that we're against progress, but that we feel like we lose things when things change. So mm-hmm. how do we process that?
Yeah, well, cool. What environmental factors are demonstrated to be helpful or limiting to creative process?
What environmental factors, like where do I go to be creative, or how mm-hmm. do I find that space? It's funny, I in the new show, I have this line that I say, I have a thing about tables. I love tables because with my public address systems and my public engagement work, they always seem to be centered around a table, you know, a dining room table or a cafe table or something. And for me, if I have a table where I can put my books and my laptop and I can have some morning space at that table with a cup of coffee, that's what I need. And it sort of doesn't matter if that's in the city or if it's in the country, which I like to work in the country, but I also like to work in the city. All I need is that table space. So, and that quiet in the morning. So that's one thing. I mean, for those of us who are performers, of course, we need another kind of space where we can get up and move around. And having a decent sized theater space or rehearsal space doesn't need to be much. I mean, when we started our work, we started making our work in our living rooms, you know, because we didn't have access. But just a big enough room to walk around and move around in and invite your friends in, because I'm a big collaborator. And I don't like to spend much more time than my morning time by myself. I really like to bring people around. And I like to bring people around in a kind of a living situation where we can eat together as well and share things together that aren't just work, so that the work is inspired by living around each other. I think that's really important.
That's interesting. So does your work challenge any assumptions or conventions?
I think it does. I think the first and most obvious thing it challenges is what it means to be a lesbian, because we don't do plays about coming out. You know, we don't do the kinds of lesbian representation that you might see on TV, you know, which I'm really thankful for and glad it's out there. We really take the sort of the fact that we are lesbian women who are working on these shows as a given. And then we look at other subjects like the economy, or like having a stroke, or, you know, other going through menopause. So we don't make our work about being gay or being lesbians. So I think that that in some ways, and when people look at us, I don't think they see the typical lesbians on stage, because we're inhabiting loads of other different kinds of bodies, although there are some stereotypical bodies that we work and play with on stage. So I think maybe we upend certain ideas about what that means to people. But theatrically, I think we also, you know, I love theater. I fell in love with theater and all the conventions of theater. But I like to expose those conventions so that we use them, but we sort of twist them and turn them so that you see the magic of them, but you also see how they work at the same time. And so people usually use theater to create an illusion. And I like to use the conventions of theater to break illusions and create different illusions. So that kind of goes against traditional theater. And also, we don't do linear plays. So we don't have a plot line or we don't have a story. Very often, we have two or three stories going on at the same time. So that's become more common. More people see that more often. You see it on TV even these days. But when we first started making work, not very many people worked that way. They didn't work. They worked in a, you know, there was always a big crisis or there was always a climax and then, you know, the show ended. Yeah. But we never have a climax in the show. So,
nobody ever climaxes.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say that. I won't say that. I won't go that far.
Okay.
There are other kinds of climaxes.
Okay, good. Well, what is the role of education in your creative expressions?
It's interesting. I have two answers to that, two kinds of answers to that. Because I grew up in, you know, rural Virginia, and I grew up, you know, going to school in Mount Pleasant and in Vinton, and now that I'm living in cities like New York and London, I meet people who had a very different kind of education as a child and as a teenager. And, you know, while I had a very decent life and a very decent education, there are a lot of limitations that, I mean, there's a lot of, I was not exposed to the arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the plays that we did in high school were not dramatic literature. They're nothing that you would have heard of, you know, they were just little school plays that we did. So there's, when I think back on my education, I feel a lack of that kind of foundational knowledge about culture and art. On the other hand, I had to make it all up as I went along. You know, I made it up for myself. I mean, I started out going to church, you know, at the Baptist church. So a lot of my creativity went into, you know, memorizing things for the GAs or making posters or making little plays for church. And then same happened when I was a cheerleader. A lot of creative energy went into how to have pep rallies or how to direct pep rallies. So I had used what I had. And also cheerleading itself taught me how to use my own movement as creative way of being. And then when I went to college, that's when I was able to like find and study aspects of theater and other kinds of art and culture. But even then, it wasn't a deep education. So that I am constantly making up for that, and I'm constantly making things up as I go along. It's much more self-taught. And on some days, I love that. And on other days, I'm sorry that I didn't have the kind of background that I see other people have.
Yeah.
But I am an educator, but that's the other part. So for me, I have never not also been a teacher as well as a performer and a director and a writer. And I love being in the classroom, and I love teaching, and I love encouraging people to make their own work and giving them opportunities and skills and techniques for doing that. So in a sense, the idea of education has never left me, and in fact informs a lot of my work, like Tammy's whole series of plays called What Tammy Needs to Know is really about addressing my lack of education and my commitment to education.
Cool. Well, is risk-taking a part of your creativity?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, there are some people who take massive risks in terms of the subject matter. They like to cross boundaries and break taboos. I wouldn't say that's my primary purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I take a lot of risks because I use my own personal material as subject matter. And I explore my own vulnerabilities and my own questions in public with people. I think there's risk in that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just as risky as taking your clothes off, although I've done that as well. And I think, to be perfectly honest, I think it's a risk being an artist these days. You don't have the same kinds of access to security that you do if you decide to become another profession that gives you a full-time job and a full-time employment. You also don't get the same kind of validation. Society, or certainly a society in this country,
mm-hmm.
doesn't value artists the same way a lot of other cultures do. And you're constantly feeling like you're on the margins, or that you're, you know, a stepchild of some kind. So I think just being an artist has lots of risks involved. And also, the material, you have to dig deep inside you when you're an artist. And sometimes that's scary. That can be a scary process.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you intend to achieve through your art?
Mm-hmm. I have to connect with people, I think, is my main thing. And to give people some faith in the power of the imagination. I have this phrase that I like to say, which is, you know, if you can imagine something, you can change it and you can make it change. Because a long time ago, I thought, why am I doing theater when there's so many terrible things going on in the world, you know, and the education system's falling apart. We need teachers. This was during AIDS crisis. So many people are dying. People aren't paying attention to that. I just thought, what's the point of doing theater? And someone said to me, if we can't imagine ourselves out of a situation, we're lost. And that's what art does. It helps us imagine ourselves in a different place, or maybe a better place, but we can imagine our way out. So I think that's my goal. And one of the greatest compliments I have ever gotten, and I still get this sometimes, is because of the nature of our work, which is a little bit of a DIY aesthetic. People, and because of its personal material, people will often come up after a show and say things like, "You made me feel like I could do that." And I think I wouldn't have thought of it as a goal, but it certainly feels like an accomplishment.
Yeah. Well, who is your greatest influence?
Look, that's a really good question. I mean, one of my greatest teachers is a woman named Muriel Miguel. And she was the founder of Spider Woman Theater Company. And this was the Native company that I worked with, Native American company that I worked with in New York when I first came to New York. And I learned so much from her about making the kinds of performance that I do she and her company still does. And that is that personal details are important, and the material of our own lives is important material for making work. And she also taught me that it was okay to make mistakes. She took some guidance from the Hopi Indian goddess Spider Woman. That's why she named the company Spider Woman. And the myth of Spider Woman, one of the myths of Spider Woman is that, or as she told it, is that Spider Woman taught her potters and her weavers to always leave a flaw in the design so that the spirit could come and go. And if it's too good and too perfect, there's no spirit and there's no breath. And I think that's one of the greatest things that she taught me. And that's something that we think about when we make our work, is that we allow the flaws to be there because it allows people to feel like they can come and go in the work. She also taught me about fantasy. And that's a really important part of our work. And I didn't mention this when you ask about process. We always start with what our performance fantasy is. What do you fantasize wanting to do on stage? Even if it doesn't feel or seem like it's achievable because you don't have the talent or the money or the right body for it. You know, if I wanted to say, my fantasy is being a ballet dancer, we use that fantasy to create something. We let that be a little engine for making the performance. Maybe I'll dress like a ballet dancer. Maybe I'll do a dance. Maybe it's nothing to do with that. Maybe it's just to do with how I wear my hair. But there's influence that happens when you keep going back to what your desires are. Go back to what it is you want to make. Go back to what you want to change in the world. Go back to what you want to perform on stage in front of a lot of people.
All right. Well, how has your artistic expressions changed over time?
That's a really hard one, I think, because I think the first thing that came into my mind is that they haven't changed, but they've refined in a way. And part of the reason they've refined is that the process has become refined. So now when we start to make a piece of work, we already have a lot of vocabulary in place and a lot of muscle in place to make that happen. So we don't have to make up everything as we go along. We've got some things to lean back on. Mm-hmm. But I think we kind of answered that question earlier when I said, when you asked me about the public engagement work, I think in lots of ways we've gone from being just us on stage to trying to get everybody on stage, and not literally, but try to have much more physical and verbal connection with people. And I think maybe over time, my work has changed that way. At the same time, I feel like our performances have become more refined and more virtuosic in a way, because we've gotten older and better at what we do.
Well, who are your favorite artists and why?
Well, I love Dolly Parton as a entity in the world. I love her music. I love more than that. I love her ability to use femininity in this way that makes you feel like she is absolutely in control, that there's nobody else controlling her. She's doing what she's doing because that's what she is and that's what she wants to do. And so I like playing with femininities and performing femininities. And she can really do that without becoming the object of the gaze. She is her own subject. Mm-hmm. And like Peggy says, you know that no one would ever touch her if she didn't want to be touched, you know, and you can really tell that. And at the same time, she's incredibly welcoming, you know, because she pulls people in. Mm-hmm. There's a theater company here called the Wooster Group, and they've been around almost as long as we've been around as a company. And it's not the kind of work that I would want to do because it's much more technological. They use lots of video and they do a lot of sync to video. But they do take iconic plays and iconic ideas apart, and it's like taking a car apart and looking at them in different ways. I love what they do. I'd go see anything that they do. I love Laurie Anderson, the performance artist Laurie Anderson. Mm-hmm. I just think she's an amazing storyteller, and she can do anything. And I love her focus. Oh, I love loads of people for lots of different reasons.
Well, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of the fact that I came from Mount Pleasant and have been able to make work on my own terms, creating my own aesthetic, my own process, my own outcome, and to share that with so many people around the world in so many places. I'm proud that I've never lost my sense of my roots in that red dirt of Virginia. I'm still very much connected to it, but I also feel like I'm a citizen of the world, so I love that. I'm also very specifically proud of the fact that in 1983, we brought our first show, Split Bridges, to Roanoke, and we performed it at Roanoke College and in the church on the campus at Roanoke College, and it brought so many different people from so many places. It brought, you know, people who knew my family because it was a story about my family. It brought a lot of lesbian women who live in the area because it was produced by a group who used to produce events for lesbian women. It brought people who were interested in folk art and performance theater. It just mixed up so many people. And people knew how to get there and how to behave because it was in a church. And it wasn't the Waltons. It was a very complex portrait of these three women that I'd always heard about as kids. And people laughed and got it and understood the poetry of it. They went with it. They didn't feel like they didn't get it because it didn't have a climax or a plot. I'm really proud of that moment. It was a moment where it felt like all my worlds came together on one stage in a church, which was really wonderful. And then I'm proud of this theater that we created in 1980. We made this theater called Wow, which was just, it started out as a storefront, and now it's a loft theater here in the Lower East Side of New York. And we started out and we were determined to make it a collective and have, you know, we weren't going to have a board of directors. We weren't going to have an artistic director. We weren't going to apply for funding. We were going to make it work as a collective where everybody put in work in order to be able to do their work in that space. And it's still going for, you know, these 42 years later. That's and awesome. I felt like it was a social and political experiment that we believed in, and it's still working. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, you should be. Well, what's the best piece of advice you've been given?
I was in Paris right before the pandemic. I got this residency in this university there, and I just randomly met this woman who was an American but living in Paris, and she had been a punk rocker in New York in 1970s, and she had moved to Paris and had kids. And she said that she told her kids three things: don't judge, don't compare, and don't regret. And even though it's quite recent, I've been living by those three things, because I think they're really important pieces of life information.
Oh, yeah. Well, what is the role of an artist in society?
Well, I think I kind of answered that a little bit in the question when I talk about imagination. I think the role of the artist is to help us see differently. And if we can see differently, to help us imagine how things could be different. You know, I think the role of the artist is to see what we all see, but then show it to us in a different way. That maybe opens up that perception and opens up our sense of reality a little bit, so that we expand in our thinking and expand in our sight and in our thought. So it's really about artists use their imagination to change something, to help us think about what kinds of changes are possible.
Well, thank you for sharing your creative process with our listeners, Lois.
Well, thanks for asking all these really great questions. I really enjoyed talking to you, Heather. Thank you.
You have been listening to Lois Weaver, a Guggenheim-winning artist and performer, activist and director. And I'm Heather Rose with Radio Free Roanoke, 95.7 FM.
Hello, this is Lois Weaver, and you are listening to WROELP Roanoke.